Anyone that knows me knows that I despise speaking at meetings. It's my least favorite form of service. I'd rather set up chairs. I'd rather come early and do coffee. In fact, I had the coffee commitment with my sponsor at this meeting back in the, when it was over at the log cabin, back in the 90s sometime. That was my favorite form of service. Set up chairs, do the coffee in the background. This is what I don't like to do. But when your sponsor asks you to do it, you you can't come up with a good reason not to. So, all right, two things to start off, because I'm going to get out. Really, the important things that I'm going to say are going to happen right now. The rest of it's going to be blah, 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 and whatever you need, you know, nap or whatever. But two things. One, what I say today is all my opinion. The program is in the big book. The program is in the steps. That's the program. What I say today is all my opinion on how I've done things and how I haven't done things. And the second thing is that I think is the most important thing I'm going to say today is just don't leave no matter what. That's all you have to remember from what I have to say today. Just don't leave no matter what. So I'll give you some... And again, this is another thing. I have no idea where this is going to go. So don't try to follow anything kind of linearly because you'll get lost because I'm already lost. Just kind of like, you know, follow the bouncing ball and just go with it. Don't try to put a structure in this. I came to this program in 1985 on the heels of Alcoholics Anonymous. Came in. Got abstinent. At that time when I came in, I needed to lose about 65, 70 pounds. Got abstinent, lost the weight, maintained the weight loss, maintained an abstinence for somewhere around, I don't know, 10 years, 9 years, 10 years, I don't remember. Somewhere along the line, I just kind of drifted. I just kind of drifted out. And then you turn around and you say, well, am I really abstinent? My weight was starting to go up. And then, for one reason or another, and who remembers back that far, I just stopped showing up. You know, started with, you know, going to 3-4 meetings a week, and then it was 2-3 meetings a week, and then it was 1 meeting a week, and then it was a meeting every other week, and before you know it, I'm back out there. So this disease, they talk about it being progressive. I'm the poster child. I came in needing to lose 65, 70 pounds. I came back into program in 2005. I was over 300 pounds, and I was 150 pounds overweight. I never thought I would ever reach that. In fact, I used to listen to people talk about their weight and say, I think, how could they ever let themselves go like that? You know, I used to hit 235 pounds, and that was when I would start my diet and go back. I was a yo-yo diet, up and down and up and down and up and down. I tried all the diets out there. I had my own that worked. Actually, I'll share this one with you. Don't ever try this one, but I don't think you can do it anymore because they don't make one of the products that was part of it. So I used to have a size called the three T's, tuna, tab, and tar. It was half a can of tuna fish a day, two-liter bottles of tab. And if you don't know, tab was a diet drink that was back many years ago, and 5 packs of cigarettes. That was the tar. But I'm an addictive personality, alcoholic, smoker, the whole thing. So... And I would do that diet. It worked great. I could lose 65, 70 pounds in somewhere about 8 to 10 weeks. And then once I got back to eating real food again, that came right back on. So I did that back and forth and back and forth. And I think one of the reasons what got me into program was what I had made the mistake of quitting smoking. And thank God I did that before program because I don't think I ever would have been able to quit smoking once I got clean and sober. And that just would have happened. Anyway... I told you, don't try to follow this. So I had quit smoking, so I couldn't do the three T's, and the tuna and the tab just didn't do it. So my weight had gone up. I hit the 235, and I couldn't get a diet started, and that's what actually wound up bringing me into program. My Eskimo was a cousin of mine who, knowing I was going to AA, and she mentioned Overeaters Anonymous to me, and I thought, it's ridiculous. But I figured, what the hell, show up. And that's what set me off in this program. So anyway, I came back into program in 2005. And anyone that knew me at the time knew, don't mention program to me. Because most of my friends because I'd been in program for many years, most of my friends were still in program, still program friends, but they all knew, don't mention OA. Don't mention it, because they pretty much get a response of, go fuck yourself. And back in, so back in 2005, I get a phone call one night from my friend Carl. And he says, what about dinner and a meeting tomorrow night? Now, if he called the night before, I would have told him where to go. And for some reason that night, I said, sure. So the next night, we went to dinner, and we went to the 100 Pounders meeting in San Fernando Valley at the Darby office. And I was so ashamed, because I was 100 Pounder. I never came into this program as a 100 Pounder. And I sat there, and I saw people that I knew, and some people that hadn't seen me in a while, and it was tough. But I just kept coming. I got abstinent. I lost my weight. Here's the kicker. This is where I don't know much about. I know I have a spiritual life today, and I believe in a power greater than myself that I rely on a daily basis, on an hourly basis sometimes. I don't know what God is and what God isn't, but I choose to call my higher power God, because it's easier than saying higher power. It's one syllable. But here's the kicker. Carl called me up and invited me to that meeting, and I've been coming back ever since. Carl passed away about 10 weeks later. Went out for a walk and had a massive heart attack and died. Now, not to trivialize his life, but I believe he was in my life at that moment to get me back into program, because that's what saved my life. That's why I hate speaking. I've been coming back ever since then. I haven't been abstinent ever since then. So just to jump ahead, I'm going to go back and forth. In February, I celebrated 3 years of abstinence. So from 1985 to it's not been a continual thing. Now, I've been clean and sober since 1985. See, the food and the drugs and alcohol are very different. I'm really good with black and white. I don't drink no matter what. I don't use no matter what. I don't smoke no matter what. But food is different. Food is different. But here's the other kicker. I'm a sugar addict. And I don't eat sugar no matter what. Even when I broke my abstinence, I did not go back to the sugar. Now, I'm also here to tell you, you don't need to eat sugar to put on weight. Haven't touched sugar. It's black and white. You just don't eat sugar. I've been off sugar for so many years. My kids, my one son, they're both in their 20s now, have never known me to eat sugar. And they don't, I don't know why this comes up, but they don't even know I'm in this program. All right, that's another story altogether. But they just think, Daddy doesn't like sugar. We'll be at a restaurant, and they'll come around asking for dessert orders, and they'll come to me, and they'll say, he doesn't eat sugar. He doesn't like it. And they have no clue. And again, I'm not going to go into that whole tangent, but they... Anyway, it's amazing how things pop into my mind. This is my life is a tangent, and that's how my mind works. So, anyway, where was I? I was talking about something. I've been abstinent since February, 3 years ago. It was 3 years in February. I always do my abstinence and discuss my abstinence in terms of where I'm at today and where it's been, and not where it's going. Because since relapse has been in my history, I don't take today for granted. I don't say, well, I'm coming up on X time of abstinence, because I have no clue. Right now, I'm coming up on 9:30, and that's about as far as I will project it. And I will probably stay abstinent through the end of this meeting. But if any of you ever see me leave a meeting when I wasn't abstinent, I would leave a meeting and go through a drive-through and binge my brains out. So I don't project it. I know that right now I'm abstinent. I've had abstinence for the last 3.5 years, and I have no idea if I'm going to have the rest of the day of tomorrow. I'm going to trust that if I do everything I did yesterday and the day before and the day before to keep my abstinence, that I will make it out through the end of the day today and still be abstinent. So when I came back, I got abstinent, lost 150 pounds, kept it off, maintained an abstinence for somewhere between 4 and 5, 6 years. I don't even remember. And then slowly started, you know, that little insidious bite here, bite there, exception here, exception there. And before you know it, I'm putting on weight and putting on a lot of weight. And I turn around and I'm looking and say, I can't really call myself abstinent. So I decided to, you know, come clean and you know, say I was an abstinent and stop counting time, because counting time is ridiculous if you're not abstinent. It's a number. So, and there's a lot of ego involved. You know, well, yeah, 5 years abstinent. So, but 5 years abstinent, but you're 30 pounds up. This is all for me. This is all my opinion, by the way. So anyway, I spent about 4.5 to 5 years coming to meetings and not being able to get abstinent. I just could not rub 2 days together. I'd get 30 days, I'd get 60 days, I'd be back again, back and forth and back and forth. But I kept showing up. And I kept, especially one commitment, I kept a commitment at a Saturday morning meeting. It was out in Burbank. And I kept the setup committee because I had to be there. And I had the key. And if I didn't show up, then I couldn't get in and set the meeting up. So I kept that commitment. It kept me showing up to meetings. That's why I say just don't leave. And it was tough. It's tougher to come to meetings when you're not abstinent than when you're abstinent. It's tougher to come to meetings when your face is in the trough, because you're sitting there and you're judging yourself and you feel everybody in the room is judging you and they're seeing you getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But I kept showing up. And every 6 months when they would change that position, I just held on to that fucking key. Excuse my French. Pardon me. I just wouldn't give up the commitment. And I take a co. Oh, yes, someone else is telling me, but I'm going to keep that key. And I think that really it was the key for me keeping showing up. And here's the thing. I was at that meeting. It was February 15th, back in whatever year it is, 3 years ago. And I'm sitting down, and during pitch time, I get a kick on the chair from the guy next to me and says, get up and pitch. Now, I never pitch. I don't like to pitch. I don't like to do this. I don't even like to do a 3-minute pitch. My hand shot up. I got up and pitched. And I pitched about the shame that I had. I pitched about the shame about having this thing to begin with. I pitched about my shame about that I couldn't stop eating and that I couldn't get abstinent after all these years. And that I and the fact that I was just getting bigger and I couldn't stop. And I sat down from that pitch and I've been abstinent ever since. Now, if I hadn't been in that place at that time, I probably wouldn't be sitting here in front of you guys today talking to you. And that's why I say the most important thing is just don't leave. Because you just don't know. You don't know when it's going to hit. And if you're not in the place to and open to it at that moment, it's going to pass you by, and I do believe that. And the other thing is, you don't know what you do for other people, what you say, and what the impact you have on someone else. Carl had no clue the day he called me and asked me to go to dinner in a meeting. He had no clue that day that was going to set me back into this program for good. I haven't left since then, and I don't know. What it was. Again, this is all the stuff about God that I don't understand. Here's my thing about God and higher power. I don't really have to understand what God is and what God isn't. I just know I believe there is a God and that I trust and rely on. I have no clue how my truck works. I get in my truck and turn the key. As long as I put gas in and keep up the maintenance, that truck starts and gets me back and forth where I'm going. I have no clue how it works. It's the same way with God. I don't have to know how and why God works. I just trust that it does, as long as I do my part. And that's the key thing, is doing the maintenance stuff. So what I do for my abstinence today, I do things that I swore I would never do. Never do. First of all, I commit my food. No way in hell was I ever going to commit my food. People used to talk about committing their food, and I think, come on, I'm a grown man. I'm not going to commit my food. You know, what am I, a child? Yeah, you know what? I commit my food. I do a 10th step every night. And in my 10th step, I write down whether any changes to my food from the day. And I write down what I'm going to have the following day. And in the morning, I read this to my sponsor. And he gets my committed food for the day. I committed from the night before. And the only time something changes, and that's the other thing, I put a statement in where there's been any changes, but before I make a change, I always run it by him. Whether it's a text, I text and let him know there's going to be a change. And the changes aren't if I decide, you know, I decided I'm going to have pizza instead of, no. The changes have come up because something has come up that's preventing me from having what I planned on eating. So typically two things will happen. The first thing is I will text my sponsor and say, I'm having, you know, this instead of that. And the next thing is I write about my resentments for my son who ate the chicken that I was planning on having for dinner that night. But it's all committed. I swore I would never commit my food. Here I go. But I've been doing it for 3 years back in February. I've been committing my food every day. I do a 10th step every night, which is another thing that, you know, I dabbled in a 10th step. I dabbled in here and this and that, but I do a 10th step every night. I call my sponsor every morning, which I'm lucky to have that ability. And, you know, it goes back and forth. Right now we're at 6:15 in the morning. We've been at 5, at 5:30. We've gone back and forth, schedules change and so on. But I call my sponsor every morning. Every now and then something comes up and I, you know, schedules change and snap, but for the most part, it's every morning we talk. And the other thing is prayer and meditation. Now, again, I'm doing things today that I swore I would never do, and I thought were most ridiculous things that I've heard of. So I have this God box. Now, if you had told me 5 years ago that I was going to have a God box, I would say, what are you, crazy? That is the silliest thing. What's a God box? I mean, come on. God, you know. So I have a God box now. And I won't go into the story of how it all came about, but it was just one of those sequence of events where you turn around and you say, is it odd or is it God? And I choose for today to believe it was God. And I got this God box now. And when there's major stuff going on, I write it down and I put it in my God box. Now, it's not magic. It's not like, you know, abracadabra. But what the God box is for me, it's a physical representation of I'm turning it over to God. It's in God's hands. And when it naturally comes back up and I start worrying about the thing again, it's like, no, it's in your God box. It's in God's hands. And it's just, it's a physical reminder. And when I see the God box, it reminds me that the stuff that I have going on is in there. It's in God's hands. It's not magic, but it works. And so I do it. And I the first time I told somebody that I had a God box, they laughed because they knew my feelings about these things. And you know what? I've learned never say never, because it's amazing what I do today, the things that I do today. Thank you. That I would never have thought I would be doing. I sponsor. I have a sponsor. And I do this thing to the best of my ability. I don't do it perfectly. The only thing I can say, I don't think anyone say does it perfectly, but, you know, even my food, you know, my food isn't perfect, but it's all committed. And that's the thing. I don't decide, like, you know, I'm going to have this tonight instead of what I committed, and, you know, for any reason. But if I'm going to eat something, I'm going to commit it. And that's, you know, for someone that used to eat in hiding. I mean, when I was in front of people, they had no clue why I put on so much weight, because in front of people, I ate like a gentleman. My hat was off to me. But once I left and was in behind closed doors or in my car or in my car in an alleyway munching down, all bets were off. So the thought of telling somebody what I ate and what I'm going to eat and when I'm going to have something that someone will say, oh, you're going to eat that? And I'll commit it. It's all out in the open. So it, and even that is something that I thought I wouldn't do. I just be that open with what I eat. And my abstinence, I eat three times a day, nothing in between. I don't snack because I only want to have to eat three times a day. I do not want to have to deal with it more than that. God bless people that snack. I just can't do it because for me, a snack turns into a fourth meal. So that's how I deal with it. I try to make my food as black and white as possible because I know me. I'm good with the black and whites. The sugar, I mean, to me, the sugar is a miracle. The fact that I don't eat sugar today is a miracle. And again, it's black and white. I also don't eat the sugar-free products because, you know, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck. So it's too close. So, but for today, the desire to stop, and there's sugar all around my house. My kids eat it. My wife eats it. There's all of it's just it's there. It doesn't like ring. It's just cause again, it's black and white. So I try to keep my abstinence as black and white as possible, and that's what helps me. I don't mess with it, and that's for today. It's all for today. It's all to 9:30 because that's about when I'm going to wrap this thing up, and then after this, all bets are off. But like I said before, I have enough trust in God that if I do everything that I've done for the last, you know, yesterday's, there's a good chance I'll end today abstinent. But beyond that, you know, we'll see what happens day at a time. So that's all I got. And I appreciate Michael for asking me to speak today. Actually, I was supposed to speak in 2 weeks. And one of the fellows that was supposed to speak today, she canceled and asked me if I would switch. And so anyway, you'll hear her in a couple of weeks. She's a lot better than I. Okay. After the seventh tradition. Okay, so now we're going to pass out the music books and we're going to sing for one. All right, this is the time for questions only. There is no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader are my own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. Please remember, if you ask a question, your voice may be audible on the OA podcast. Leader, please restate the question. Okay. Questions.
Thank you so much for your share and your accent.
What accent?
If you're comfortable sharing, I'm curious how do you live this abstinence life without your kids knowing? That seems like a challenge.
Why did I open Pandora's box? Okay, so, yeah, how do I do this without my kids knowing? All right, so, great question. And see, you know, again, when I said before, is it odd or is it God? Okay, then it's God. So, here's the thing. It's difficult. Next question. So, as you may have picked up from what I said, I have a lot of shame about this particular aspect of my illness. People know I'm an alcoholic addict. They know that I'm an ex-smoker. I can count on half of one hand how many people outside this program, one of them is my wife, so now there's at least only two, that know I even come to this program. And it's all about, I still have a lot of shame about this thing. You know, just the fact that, black, you can't stop eating. And that's, again, it's my own shit. And you think by now, after how many years dealing with this, that it would be a little different, but it's not. That's just where it is for today. Now, this thing came up about a couple of days ago, so that's why I say I'm being prodded. So thank you for being a prod. My kids didn't know until recently that I was an alcoholic. They just knew I didn't drink. But when they started having, especially my one son started having some issues with drugs and alcohol, I actually sat him down and let him know. Because I felt he needed to know that, because I do believe there's a genetic component to this. he needed to know all the details of what goes on inside of him that may he might be predispositioned for an issue. But neither one of them have a food thing, so I've never brought this up. And what's really been interesting, which has been, so the last 3 years or so, I don't know, there was this little pandemic thing that went around, and we were doing all meetings on Zoom, which I go to a meeting every day, which is, that's one of the benefits of, one of the silver linings to this thing is that the Zoom meetings. So every day I go to a meeting in my shop, because in my shop, lock the doors, no one comes in my shop. My kids have no clue that I'm in my shop going to an Overeaters Anonymous meeting or an AA meeting or whatever. I've been struggling with it because my wife thinks I'm nuts, but she won't say anything to them. But I have yet to tell them, and it's not easy. Today, coming to this meeting, my son has some stuff that he wants me to do with him. I say, I'll be back. I'm going to go see some friends, and then, you know, which I am. I think I'm a friend with one of you. But it's difficult, and it's all about my inability to. There's a part of me that doesn't accept that this is, you know, that it's okay. Really, that it's okay. It's not a character defect. It's not a value judgment on who I am as a person. It's just, it's a disease. And I see it with everything else. But this one I have the harder time with. So, again, thank you for prodding. Now, gentle. Be gentle.
So, through the course of doing, like, 4 steps,
what character defect did he describe as a surprise? The issues weren't so much a surprise, but the surprise is how, what it comes down to, the fear. How everything, a lot of everything, gets backed into fear. And that was interesting because fear was not something that was an acceptable emotion in my family. Anger and rage were the two acceptable emotions. Fear, you weren't allowed to be afraid. I distinct memories of, we're not going to go into that. It's a too long story. But the fact that so many of things and how fear affected so many decisions in my life that even my, you know, so someone mentioned my supposed accent, which I don't have, it's proper English. I obviously am not a native Californian, although I do claim to be so. I came out here in 1982. I left New York in the middle of the night, took a road trip. 6 months later, I wound up in California. I've moved around a lot. I've come to learn a lot of this moving around, the geographics. And a lot of the geographics really had a root in fear. Not at the time. At the time it was, you know, I want to do this, I want to do that, you know, I'm tired of being here. But it was fear, even of just being in myself and what am I doing next, and instead of facing that or doing something about it, it was easier to jump in the car and be somewhere else. For my first about 7-8 years in abstinence, I used to joke about the fact that I had a go bag in my trunk, and at the drop of a hat, I could be in Portland. And that was my battle cry. I'm going to Portland. And I stayed. So, I mean, I moved around here a lot, but I haven't. But yeah, I think that seeing how the underlying drive in my, a lot of the things in my life was fear.
Thank you. You speak about black and white, not eating sugar. And I wonder, was that a process or that was just straight off, I just don't do it?
Yeah, It didn't happen overnight. I mean, when I first stopped, okay, and to give you a little background on the kind of, when I say I'm a sugar addict, this wasn't, I like to eat sweets, and I like the taste of sugar. I ate so much sugar, I'm surprised that I'm not a diabetic at this point. I had, if you don't have a problem mentioning foods, I'll give you basically what I would eat on a somewhat daily basis, maybe 4 to 5 times a week. I had a routine. I would get a box of Twinkies, 2 dozen donuts, Oreos, cookies and cream ice cream, a jar of nuts, 2 pounds of peanut M&Ms, a gallon of milk, and a gallon of chocolate milk. And I would dump the peanut M&Ms and the M&Ms into the ice cream and sit and eat and drink and eat and drink until I would pass out, wake up, eat some more, and then I would take this stuff and I would crumble up what was left and throw it in the trash and say, I'm not going to do this again, I'm not going to do this again. And then I would proceed to wake up again somewhere else in the middle of the night, pull everything out of the trash and eat it. That was the kind of sugar addict that I was. The bottom that I hit with it was when I was downtown LA. I was working on a project down on Skid Row, and we were renovating this hotel down on Skid Row, and we were using these caustic chemicals to strip all the stuff in the building. And it was this one night that I was in the middle of my process, and I had some Twinkies and donuts left and everything, and I decided I'm going to crush the stuff and put it in with the stripper. So now I can't go in the trash and eat it. Woke up a few hours later, went in there, and started eating these donuts. Now, the donuts tasted horrible. They tasted like the chemical. They tasted like the stripper that we were using. But I could not stop eating them. They didn't taste good. And I started getting a panic attack. Now, my panic attack wasn't, you're poisoning yourself, you're going to die. This goes back to the shame. The panic attack was, you're eating this chemical, it's going to kill you, and they're going to know why. They're going to know you poisoned yourself eating donuts that you threw in the trash that are now poison. That's what my panic was over. And the panic attack was serious. And I ate all of the fucking donuts through the panic attack. That's how addicted I was to sugar. So it's not a taste thing. When I first got abstinent, I knew right away, you know, okay, I need to put the sugar down. And it was a process. Now, this is many years ago, so I don't remember exactly how long it took. But it was over time, because it was one of those things that was black and white. It just became not an option. And again, my personality with the black and whites eventually just got to the point where it's just not a thing. I don't even think about the thought of picking up a donut would be the same thing as me picking up a cigarette or picking up a drink. It's just not there. The food, though, like I said before, it's insidious. That's why I don't think of my abstinence. I'll be abstinent in 2 more weeks or whatever. It's all bets are off with the food. That one I have to deal with on a regular basis. So, I don't. If there was a magic answer, I probably wouldn't tell you. I'd sell it because I'm not out that altruistic. I'd make money on that. But it was really for me. It was black and white and a day at a time, and it's just not there. Yeah.
Can you talk about your process of putting down fake sweeteners? Can you talk about how you were able to put down a fake sweetener and why?
Yeah, it was one of those things where it was too close. For me, it served, it's like, I don't need it. It served no purpose. And it's been a long time now since I've had them. So, I don't remember exactly if it was easy or tough, right? I really don't remember. But I do know it was just something that it was, you know, why? Again, it, it, it's It's like drinking near beer. I don't pick up non-alcoholic beer. I don't need to do that. So it's just, if I could remember what the process was, I would tell you. But it was the decision that I made that, you know, this is not necessary. It was a day at a time, and now it's just been, I just don't do it. See, it's a problem with getting old. You forget. Yeah.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to hear you. Who helped you these past 3 years? Do you work with a nutritionist to create a food plan, or was it with your sponsor? And how do you deal when you're eating out, going to parties, like going to events, with pre-committing the food when you, like, you know, your kids want to go to a restaurant or whatever that.
Okay, well, first of all, I don't go to a nutritionist. My food plan basically evolved. I had been in enough diet programs to know what's healthy and what's not. I mean, you know, we know. And for the most part, what I eat are fairly basic foods. When I go out, and this comes up, and sometimes we don't know until all of a sudden we're going out and where we're going. And I text my sponsor, because most restaurants I go to, I can get a meal that I can live with. And I text them. I don't just decide I'm going to eat this and that. And I'll look, even if I get if I don't know the menu, I look at the menu and I excuse myself, get up from the table, and I'll text my sponsor. Just let them know I'm having X, Y, and Z. And unless I get anything back from them saying no, that's what I eat. But yeah, I don't go to a nutritionist. And not that there's anything wrong with that. That, you know, I know a lot of people that do, and it really works for them. But I, you know, I basically know that if I eat pizza 3 times a day, which I could do technically, you know, I'm not going to feel good about my abstinence. So, yeah.
Hi, thank you so much, Greg. It's great to hear you, even if you didn't want to hear it. Can you talk a little bit about how your relationship with your higher power has evolved such that you, without understanding, rely upon your higher power? And you mentioned prayer and meditation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The God stuff is tough because I feel like I've been on a spiritual journey since I can remember, before program, for years. I've always been looking for something that I knew that there was something else out there besides just what's the physical thing in front of me. I spent years pursuing different religions, different meditations, and in one form or another bounced around. I was a Christian for a while. I was brought up Catholic until they kicked me out. But nothing ever really, and my beliefs today are kind of a mix. And that's one of the things I learned. I don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. So there are things that today are part of my spiritual life that are part of the Catholicism that I grew up with. But a lot of it, it's not. I've incorporated in this, again, certain things happen. There was a musician's AA meeting that I was going to for a while. And I'm at this AA meeting, and the speaker was talking about his deal and his journey with meditation. And he was, just long story short, he uses his music for his meditation. And I thought, oh, what a concept. And I had just gotten back into my music again, so I decided to try something. And part of my meditation, what I do is I grab my guitar and I pick out a melody and I let my mind go with the melody. And it works for me. Now, I had done all different forms of meditation. I used to go to the International Buddhist Meditation Center and this and that. And you know, it never really clicked. But this thing that I do now with the music just seems to work for me. It's not traditional. I don't sit in the lotus position. I just grab my guitar, I close my eyes, I pick out a melody, and I do it. And the reason why it works for me is because since I like to play, I do it. And I think that's the key, is doing it. Whether there's no right or wrong. Whatever you choose to be your meditation, it's just, it gives me that time to just center myself and do it on a regular basis. And again, my belief in God is ever-evolving. I just know that I do trust, and I take it back. I mean, I'm human. You know, I'll turn it over. Like I said, I turn it over, and I'll take it back, and that's when that God box kicks in, because I remember. Or I see the box, and it's like, that's right, it's in the box. I don't have to worry about this right now. And it doesn't mean everything turns out my way. It just means that I'm not worrying about the result. I'm not worrying about the result. And that's the stuff that I put in my God box. I don't put it in, God, please give me this. Give me the winning numbers to the lottery. It's, help me accept the outcome to this. Help me to let go of this. Help me to live in today, no matter what, with this going on, and whatever that this is. And that's how I word my writings in the God box. It's not that I get the outcome I want, because that's where I have to leave it up to God, the outcome. And again, I don't do it perfectly. I don't have anyone that does, but it's the working toward it that I think works for me. Thank you, Jesus. Okay. Now it's time for the secretary's announcements.